Thin blood emerged beneath their crescents, until she felt vaguely awake. Dear air. She looked up and found him standing beside the fireplace. He was not so pale as she remembered. Now his cheeks were ruddy and his eyes gleamed with a sparkle that seemed unnatural. Her earlier dreams recurred. This man buried inside her, while all around them the fire burned and burned. Kelsey stood up, wiping her bloody hand on her dress. You want your freedom? Yes. Speak, she snapped. I'm tired of silence. I want my freedom. How do I kill the Red Queen? Are you ready to bargain, Tyr Eir? His eyes gleamed redly. A trick of the light, Kelsey had once assumed. And now she remembered Marlowe's old fool, who had decided to make a bargain with the devil. But even the lessons of a good book could not stand up against the weight of the tide that stood outside the city walls. The Mort were the only issue. All other considerations had become secondary. I'm ready to bargain. Finn approached, and Kelsey saw hunger burning in his eyes, a great excitement held in check. Whatever freedom meant to him, he had waited a long time. Take your sapphires in your hand. Kelsey did. Now say, I forgive you, Roland Finn. Forgive you for what? Does it matter? Yes. You are difficult, Tyr Eir. How is it true forgiveness if I don't know what I'm forgiving you for? Finn paused, his face thoughtful, and Kelsey felt a moment's satisfaction. For months she'd been flying blind in regard to her sapphires. Finn might know more than she did, but he didn't have all the information either. Perhaps you're right, he admitted. I will tell you then. Long ago, I did your family a great wrong. What wrong? Finn blinked, and Kelsey realized, astonished, that each word was costing him something. Was it possible for this creature to feel remorse? I betrayed Jonathan Tyr. This wasn't what Kelsey had expected. The fetch said you were a liar. His eyes narrowed. Let me tell you something about the man called Fetch Girl. I see your wish to wound him, and believe me, he is vulnerable. Ask him about his role in the Tyr assassination. See if he has any defense. Kelsey recoiled. I grow weary, Tyr Eir. Do we have a deal or not? You first, she replied, forcing the fetch from her head. How do I kill the Red Queen? Give me your word that you will set me free afterward. I have watched you for a long time, Tyr Eir. I know your word is good. The words reminded her of Thorn. There was something wrong here, something Kelsey was missing. If Finn had been involved in the Tyr assassination, what did that have to do with Kelsey? All of the Tyrs were dead. The Mort, her mind insisted. Think of the Mort. She needed time, time to make a good decision. But all time had run out. If there was even a possibility of killing the Red Queen, didn't that outweigh whatever threat this creature might represent? Kelsey wondered if it had been this way for her mother. Two terrible options, the Mort at the very gates, and Alyssa, blinded by the immediate danger into making the worst decision possible. I see, Kelsey whispered silently, the words falling into some dim corner of her mind. I see now how it was for you. I promise to set you free. Finn smiled, vulpine. A good bargain, Tyr Eir. Your Mort Queen came to me a long time ago, nearly a century now. She was not seeking me, but found me by accident. And once she realized what I was, she begged me to help her. Help her do what?
Become immortal. She was a young girl then, barely a woman, but already her life had been terrible, and she wished to be so strong that nothing could harm her again. Not man, not fate, not time.
Thorn had been right, Kelsey realized. You helped her then?
I did. She has distant tear blood, and for a long time I thought she was the one I was looking for. But she is flawed. Her early years left too deep a mark on her, and she focuses only on her own safety and her own gain. Your heritage is much clearer, undiluted. Sometimes I can even see him, just there, in the expressions of your face.
Who? Kelsey wondered, but she could not afford diversions. You said she could be killed?
So she can. She has a bit of your family's talent, and I taught her to refine it, to manipulate flesh, to cure herself when her body failed her. You know these lessons, Tyr Eir. You have been teaching them to yourself. But the Mort Queen is still vulnerable. Her mind is vulnerable, because deep inside her mind will always be that young girl who came to me, frightened and starving, and alone. She cannot eradicate her childhood as hard as she might try. It defines her.
Kelsey twitched, suddenly angry. She did not want to think of the Red Queen as a vulnerable child like Isha. Kelsey wanted her to be the figure of great power and terror that she had always imagined. She felt as though Finn had made everything more difficult. How is this useful to me?
The woman cannot be killed, Tyr Eir. But the child can. She knows this, and so she must have your sapphires.
What do they have to do with it?
Time, Tyr Eir, time. Surely you must have realized by now that you hold much more than two pretty necklaces. There are many magic gems out there, but Tyr's sapphire is unique. You must have discovered this, no?
Kelsey said nothing.
There are many things the Red Queen would like to change in her own history. She believes your jewels would allow her to do so, to wipe away the past that makes her weak. She wants them very badly.
So Thorn had told the truth about that as well. For a moment, Kelsey pictured the bleeding man writhing in agony at her feet. Then she thrust the image away. How would someone else make use of that past, though?
Surely anyone she might fear from childhood is dead now. Not necessarily, Tyr Eir. She fears me. But even more, she fears you.
Me?
Oh, yes. She may not admit it even to herself, but she fears you. And fear is a monstrous weakness that an industrious woman like yourself might use. The Red Queen has many defenses. But if you find the child, you find the vulnerability.
Finn splayed his hands.
Have I fulfilled my end of the bargain?
I'm not sure. What if you've lied?
Finn chuckled bitterly, his handsome face twisting. Believe me, I learned a long time ago not to play at truth with your family. The lesson came at a bitter cost.
All right.
Your end of the bargain, Tyr Eir.
What do I do?
Let me see your sapphires.
Kelsey held them out, but he recoiled.
No closer. I can't touch them.
Why not?
Punishment, Tyr Eir. The worst punishment imaginable.
The worst punishment imaginable? Someone else had used those exact words with Kelsey not long ago. The fetch, of course, standing in almost the exact spot where Ro Finn was standing now.
Take both sapphires in your hand.
Wait a minute, she interrupted.
You said you had done my family a wrong.
The Raleighs?
What wrong? He smiled. The Raleighs. The grasping Raleighs.
You may have their blood, but you're no Raleigh. You're a Tyr.
The Tyrs were slaughtered. None survived.
Are you so dense, child? Look in the mirror.
Kelsey turned and looked. From old habit, she expected to see a girl there. But instead, she found a woman, tall and lovely, her expression grave, her face prematurely lined with sorrow. Lily.
For a moment, Kelsey thought it must be a trick, some illusion concocted by Finn to sway her. She raised her hand, watching her reflection do the same. She might have been Lily herself, standing in front of the floor-length mirror that stood in the front hallway of the New Canaan house. Only Kelsey's eyes were still her own, deep green, rather than Lily's cool blue.
Was my mother one of the Tyr line, somehow?
Alyssa.
Finn giggled, a sound that chilled Kelsey.
Do you know who my father was? I do.
Who?
He shook his head, and in his eyes Kelsey saw the most alarming thing she had seen during this entire nightmare evening.
A thin vein of pity.
Believe me, Tyr heir, you don't want to know.
Mace had said the same thing. But Kelsey pressed onward.
Of course I do. Too bad. That isn't part of the bargain.
Finn gestured toward the sapphires.
Keep your end, Tyr heir.
She clasped both sapphires in her right hand.
So bad that she wouldn't want to know.
Which of the rogues' gallery in her mother's generation could it be?
I forgive you, Roland Finn.
He prompted. Kelsey closed her eyes. Her mother's face swam up before her, but Kelsey ignored it and spoke clearly.
I forgive you, Roland Finn.
In the dark of her tent, less than 5 miles away, the Queen of Mortmain woke screaming. Finn smiled wide, showing bright, sharp teeth.
Do not even consider revoking your forgiveness, Tyr heir. You gave it on your sapphires, and oathbreakers are punished. Badly.
Ah. Kelsey sat back, staring at him.
I see.
What was your punishment, then? Different, I'd imagine, from that of the Fetch?
Finn stared at her for a moment, then shrugged. I am going to pay you a great compliment, Tyr heir. Always I come to the women with this.
He circled his perfect face with one hand.
It pleases them and flatters them and muddles their thinking. But you are too clever to be distracted, and you're too honest to be flattered.
Kelsey wasn't sure of that. Her pulse had elevated, as it always did when Finn was near. But if he had been fooled, then so much the better.
You asked. So I will show you my punishment. See who I really am.
Finn's face began to change, the colour bleeding away. His hair thinned, became a ragged patchwork on his scalp. His skin whitened, the lips reddened, the eyes grew their own dark hoods. The face was that of a clown, perhaps the Joker in a deck of cards. But there was no humour in those eyes. Only a killing joy that embraced everything and nothing. Kelsey nearly screamed, but she clapped her hand over her mouth at the last moment, realizing that it would only bring her entire guard running.
It burns, Finn rasped. All the time it burns.
What happened to you?
I have been alive for more than 3 centuries. I have wished for death many times. But I cannot inflict it on myself, only on others.
Kelsey had backed up until her knees met the bed, and now she sat down, staring at him.
Do not be frightened, Tyr heir.
I am dangerous, infinitely so. But I have no immediate business with you. My hatred lies east with the Mort Queen. If you fail, I will succeed.
He moved toward the fireplace, and Kelsey felt relieved. But just at the hearth, he turned back to her, his red eyes burning.
I have no feeling, Tyr Eir, not for any living thing in this world. But at this moment, you have my gratitude, and perhaps even respect. Do not get in my way.
That depends on where your way leads you. Stay out of the Tierling. Finn's smile widened.
I promise nothing. You have been warned.
He retreated back into the fireplace, damping the flames, and Kelsey's stomach knotted in anxiety as she watched him go. Finn's form faded until there was nothing, only the sinking sense that she had not avoided Alyssa's bargain after all, that the deal she had just made might turn out to be even worse.
Too late now.
It was nearly dawn. Kelsey wondered where Lily was now. What was she doing? Had they launched the ships? To where? How had Tyr been able to protect his tiny kingdom of travellers from the collapsing world around them? The pre-crossing Earth had held more than 20 billion people. But no one had followed them to the new world. How had Tyr gotten away?
Only crossing,
Kelsey whispered again, savouring the words like a talisman. Finn had said that Tyr's jewel dealt in time. Had Tyr been able to see the future, anticipate obstacles? No, that was too simple. An undiscovered landmass in the middle of the Atlantic.
That seemed unlikely, if not impossible.
Yet they had sailed thousands of miles crossing God's ocean to land on the western shores of the New World.
Time, Tyr Eir. Time.
Finn's voice echoed in her head, and Kelsey looked up, startled, as a vision took shape before her. There were no certainties here. There never were where her sapphires were concerned. But she thought she understood, if only dimly, what had happened. Tyr's people had travelled thousands of miles across the ocean, yes. But the real journey was not in distance. The real crossing was time. An hour later, cleaned up and dressed, Kelsey went to Arliss's office, where he handed her a sheet of paper without comment. She turned it over and found, charmed, that Arliss had taken some pains with his handwriting, pushing his normally straggling letters into upright legibility. He hadn't waited for her approval of the language. Beside him was a steadily growing stack of copies.
Bill of Regency. Her Majesty, Kelsey Raleigh Glynn, 7th Queen of the Tierling, hereby relinquishes her office and places it in the hands of Lazarus of the Mace, Captain of the Queen's Guard, his heirs and assigns, to act as regent of Her Majesty's government. Should Her Majesty die or become incapacitated while this Bill of Regency is in effect, the aforementioned transfer of office shall become permanent, and the regent shall be declared ruler of the Tierling. All acts by the regent will be taken in Her Majesty's name and according to Her Majesty's laws.
That's good, Kelsey muttered. I forgot to tell you that.
But any such acts may be repudiated by decree of Her Majesty upon resumption of her throne.
Kelsey looked up at Arliss. A resumption clause?
Andalai told me to put it in.
How did Andalai know?
She just knew, Queenie, same as she always does.
Kelsey looked back down at the bill.
At such time as Her Majesty may return and resume her throne, this bill will be declared null and void. The regent will relinquish all powers of office to Her Majesty, or Her Majesty's heirs, upon sufficient evidence.
Kelsey shook her head. A resumption clause is a bad idea. It weakens Lazarus right out of the gate.
You need one, Queenie. Both Andalai and that little sibyl of hers say you'll come back.
She looked up, startled.
They do. The little one seemed particularly sure of it. Vastly changed, she said you'll be, but you will come back.
Kelsey didn't see how this could be. If she tried to kill the Red Queen, she would either succeed or fail. But either way, it seemed unlikely that she would live long after the attempt. But it was too late to change the bill now. They needed enough copies to distribute throughout New London. Kelsey sat down in the chair opposite Arliss and began to sign her way through the stack. The work was soothing but monotonous, and Kelsey's mind wandered back to the conversation with Roe Finn. Again, the nagging question recurred. Who had fathered her? If the tear line had survived somehow, it could only be because someone had been hidden during the bloody period after Jonathan Tear's assassination. A secret that old would be nearly impossible to discover. But Kelsey's paternity might provide a start.
Lady.
Mace was in the doorway. Kelsey straightened automatically, drawing her arm over the bill she was signing. But Arliss was far ahead of her. He had already whisked the entire stack of copies out of sight. What is it?
I need you to weigh in on something.
Kelsey got up from the desk, heard a slither of paper behind her as Arliss made her bill disappear as well. What is it? Mace closed the door behind him.
Penn insists on accompanying you this morning. I said no, but he won't listen. I could have him restrained when we leave, but I don't wish to do that.
What's the question?
Do you think he should come?
Kelsey nodded slowly. It would be cruel to leave him behind.
All right.
Mace lowered his voice.
But when we get back, lady, you and I will have to talk about Penn. He cannot be your close guard and your paramour all at once.
Paramour? It was such an antiquated concept that Kelsey almost laughed. But after a moment's thought, she realized that Mace had chosen the right word. Paramour. That was exactly what Penn was. Fine. We'll discuss it. Mace looked over her shoulder.
What goes on here?
We're going over the tax situation.
That's so.
Mace fixed his keen glance on Arliss.
Taxes are a crucial issue right now. Whatever Queenie wants to talk about is the issue on my desk, Mr. Mace.
Mace turned back to Kelsey. He stared at her for a very long time.
Spit it out, Lazarus.
Why not tell me what you're planning to do, lady? Don't you think I could help?
Kelsey looked down, blinking, suddenly near tears. He would not understand, she thought, not until it was all done, and at that point it would be too late to ask his forgiveness. But Mace was a Queen's Guard right down to his core. He would knock her unconscious, if necessary, to keep her from her intended course, and so she could not explain to him, nor to the rest of the guard. She would not be able to say goodbye to any of them. She thought of the day they'd all ridden up, tired and impatient, to collect her from the cottage. That departure had been terrible, just as this one would be. And yet the world had opened wide from that day onward. She remembered riding down the length of the Almont, farms all around her, the Cadell, still a blue twinkle in the distance. How she had been struck by the land, its vastness, its sweep. And remembering, she felt a tear slide down her cheek. I can't fail, or everything is lost.
Get the other three together, Lazarus.
It's time to go. Later, thinking on that ride, Isher would only remember that it should have been raining. Rain would have been fitting. But instead, the sky was a deep, clear blue, blushed with pinkish-orange clouds in the coming dawn, the light just bright enough to reveal the ocean of people on either side of the great boulevard. New London was bursting at the seams, and although it wasn't yet 6 in the morning,
The entire city seemed to have crowded into the streets. Despite the three guards with her, Isha felt very small and alone, and she was frightened. Not of death, but of failure. Last month, the mace had given her a horse, a pretty young stallion that Isha had named Sam, and Fel had been teaching her to ride. But riding a horse was much more difficult than working with a knife or sword, and Isha did not deceive herself that she was proficient. At any moment, she felt Sam might throw her, and she would rather die than have that happen now in front of all these people, in front of the mace who had chosen her to come along on this dangerous errand. Isha's weapons were currently stowed in her belt, but if anyone so much as made a move in the direction of the queen, she could be off the horse with her knife ready in 2 seconds flat. The queen rode tall and straight between the four of them, the dim light of dawn gleaming dully off her silver tiara. She looked very regal to Isha, very much as a queen should when going out to negotiate with her enemy. But the queen's hands were clenched on the reins, her knuckles fiercely white, and Isha understood that all was not as it seemed. Before they left the keep, the mace had drawn the three of them aside, speaking in a low voice. "She's up to something. Watch her close. You see any sign that she's going to bolt, raise the alarm and grab her. She can't take all four of us at once." Isha didn't know what to make of this order, or truly of the queen herself. She knew from Maman and the guard that the queen sometimes went into a trance, but nothing could have prepared her for last night. The queen, shambling from one room to another, her eyes sometimes closed, sometimes open, as she staggered forward, holding conversations with no one, even bumping into walls. The mace had cautioned them not to worry, to simply let her be, and left her in the care of Pen. But Isha did worry. In her own way, the queen reminded her of Glee, who would wander in the same manner, following things that weren't there, tormented by some other world that none of them could see. Sometimes Glee herself wasn't entirely there, and Isha had thought more than once that one day Glee might simply disappear, vanishing into her unseen world. Perhaps the mace was worried that the queen might do the same.
"Queen Kelsey!"
a man shouted, and Isha swung that way automatically, putting her hand to her knife. But it was only an old man, standing near the front of the crowd, waving at the queen. His was the first voice they'd heard raised above the murmur of the crowd. The city seemed to be stunned, all of them staring at the queen with wide, lost eyes. After perhaps 10 minutes of riding, Isha also noticed another anomaly. They had passed many thousands of people, but she had not seen a single glass of ale, not even when they passed the Cove, New London's notorious run of pubs.
"Why, they're scared sober," Isha realized.
They didn't know that the queen was going out to parley, but Isha suspected that it would have made no difference. She, like everyone, had seen the massive force spread across both banks of the Cadell. What could the queen offer to counter? Isha thought this was a fool's errand, but she was proud to be chosen, proud to be with them. When the mort came, she would not stand there defenseless, her eyes lost. She would fight to the end to keep them from reaching the queen. As the Cove ended, her heart froze. For a moment, she thought she had seen Dar, his tall form and black burning eyes in the centre of the crowd. But when the people shifted again, he was gone. The boulevard took its final turn, and the New London Bridge appeared, a long stretch of stone before them. The vast crowds of people on either side began to melt away, and Isha finally relaxed as the five of them guided their horses onto the bridge. Ahead reared the barricade. Isha was no engineer, but she saw the problem immediately. The barricade was nothing more than a hastily constructed mess of furniture and what appeared to be planks of lumber piled on both sides of the bridge. A thin aisle ran down the middle,
so narrow that it would allow passage only in single file. But the entire structure was unwieldy. The low walls that bordered the bridge would not support the barricade's height. The mace said that the mort had brought battering rams, and from the look of things, one good blow from a ram would send half the barricade straight over the sides of the bridge and into the Cadell. The Queen had clearly come to the same conclusion, for she chuckled darkly at the mess before them. "Not going to hold, is it?"
"Not a chance, lady," the mace replied. "There's only one way to properly defend a bridge. Hall's done his best with what he had, but a stiff breeze will take his barricade down."
Isha wondered what the one way could be, but General Hall had emerged from the barricade now, and she kept quiet. Hall had been in and out of the keep several times in the past week, and Isha liked to hear him speak, businesslike and to the point, with no nonsense or extraneous words. The mace said that Hall had done hero's work to hold the mort back until all of the refugees were inside the city. For a moment, Isha worried that the general would ask what she was doing here with the guard. But his eyes merely noted her before moving on to the Queen.
"Majesty."
"General, I've come to open negotiations with the mort."
"There's a contingent of them waiting on the far end of the bridge, but they're not dressed for embassy. They have two rams, and they're ready to begin."
"Is Dukat there?"
"Yes, he commands."
The Queen nodded for a moment, her face deep in thought, then turned and looked back over the city walls behind them. Following her gaze, Isha saw that every available surface of the boundary wall was packed with people, all of them staring at the bridge. The Queen scanned the wall for a long moment before looking down again, and Isha knew that she had been searching for someone, a face she did not find. The Queen sighed, her eyes full of sorrow, a sadness that Isha recognized. She had seen it in Maman's eyes more times than she could number. "I'm sorry." The mace jerked at his horse's reins with one hand, reaching out for the Queen with the other. But then they both froze, horse and rider. A moment later, Isha felt her own muscles seize, an odd, sick feeling, as though a mild cramp had spread across her entire body. From the corner of her eye, she could see that Penn and Elston, too, had frozen, Penn already off his horse and in the very act of charging forward. Isha had been part of late-night discussions among the guard, had heard their recountings of the strange power the Queen wielded. Each guard seemed to have his own conjecture on what the Queen's magic meant, how far it could go. But Isha had never heard of anything like this. She tried to speak, found that her throat would not even allow her to make a sound. "I'm sorry," the Queen repeated, "but none of you can protect me where I'm going." She dismounted, walked over to the mace, and looped the reins of her mare around his outstretched hand. The mace stared down at her, immobile, but his eyes were terrible, twin pools of hurt and fury. "Forgive me." The Queen grasped the mace's motionless hand for a moment, smiling sadly. "I'm the Queen, you see." The mace's mouth twitched, but nothing came out. "You're my regent, Lazarus. It's been arranged. I trust you to look after these people and keep them safe." The Queen stared at the mace for another long moment, then turned to the three of them, Isha and Elston and Penn. "You can't guard me any longer. So do this for me. Guard my regent." Isha stared at her, bewildered, for the idea of anyone guarding the mace seemed laughable. The Queen moved over to General Hall, and for a moment Isha thought that the general might be able to stop her. But then she spotted the cords standing out on his throat, and understood that he was held immobile as well. "Retreat from the bridge immediately, General, and prepare for siege. If the mort don't come, you will know that I succeeded. Now she moved toward Penn, whose pleasant face had frozen in a rictus of agony. The Queen placed a light hand against his cheek for a moment. Isha saw her shoulders heave with a single deep breath, and then she turned and darted into the shadows of the barricade. In the Queen's wake, the guards could do nothing but stare at each other. Isha thought that she was the only one who remained calm. The eyes of the other three were wide with panic. Penn appeared to be the worst of all. He would have followed the Queen anywhere. Isha knew, and the Queen had known too. There were other soldiers in the barricade. Surely they would be able to stop her. But then, staring at the maze of debris, Isha realized how foolish that hope was. The Queen was powerful, more powerful than Maman. Maybe even as powerful as the Red Queen herself. No one would stop her. Not if she didn't want to be stopped. Beneath Isha's feet, the ground began to shake. A moment later, she realized that she could move again, that the strange hold on her muscles had released. But the ground was now heaving so violently that she lost control of Sam and fell from his back, landing with a painful thud on the cobbles.
"We can still catch her up," the mace shouted. "Come on!"
Penn was already gone. He had left his horse behind and charged into the barricade. Isha pulled herself up from the ground, aware now of a deep, distant cracking, like thunder, to the east. She followed the mace and Elston into the barricade, trying to keep up with the grey of their cloaks, pulling her knife as she went. As always, the knife was a cold comfort in her hand, and only now, in her extremity, did Isha realize where that comfort sprang from. The hope that she would meet Dar. She hated Dar, and she loved him. But some day, somehow, she hoped to meet him with a knife in her hand. Another deep rumble of thunder slammed the bridge, jarring the stone beneath Isha's feet. She passed soldiers tucking into crevices in the debris, but there was no time to really see them. They were not important, not in the way the Queen was important. Isha pushed through, dodging the outthrust points of wood and chair legs. At last she emerged from the shadowy overhang of the eastern end of the barricade to find Mace, Penn, and Elston standing at a flat halt. Isha drew up beside them and gasped. At least 100 feet of the New London Bridge had vanished, leaving a cracked lip of rock, then nothing. Peering over the edge of the precipice, Isha saw several massive chunks of white stone far below, partially submerged in the rich blue waters of the Cadell. Their edges were ragged, as though a giant had torn the stone off in pieces with his bare hands. There was now an enormous gap in the bridge, stretching from the jagged edge at their feet all the way to the last column of support. Isha spotted the Queen, standing on the eastern edge of the precipice. Isha had good vision, and even from here she could see that the Queen's face was bone-white, that she looked ready to faint. The sun was just beginning to rise behind her, a nimbus of light playing around her head, and the Queen seemed very small. Isha wasn't a real Queen's Guard yet, but she thought she could understand, if only dimly, how the other three must feel. She hated seeing the Queen standing across that gulf, unprotected and alone. "Damn you, lady!" Penn shouted. Isha gasped, but the mace didn't say anything, so she knew she was supposed to pretend that she had not heard. "I am damned, Penn," the Queen shouted back. Isha snuck a cautious glance at the mace and winced at his expression. For the first time, she thought he looked old, old and used up. Only 3 days ago he had taught her how to take a sword to an attacker's knees, and applauded when she got it right. How could everything change so quickly? "I had no options, Lazarus," the Queen called across the chasm. "I never had any. You know that." She splayed her hands, then turned and walked away toward the eastern toll gate, beyond which a wave of black uniforms stood motionless and waiting.
The Queen strode into the middle of them as though into a hive of bees, and was engulfed. The four of them could do nothing but watch silently, and a few minutes later, when the Mort lines reformed, the Queen was gone. Chapter 14. The Red Queen. Fortune favours the bold, history tells us. Therefore it behooves us to be as bold as possible. The Glyn Queen's words, as compiled by Father Tyler. Ever since they had left the keep, Kelsey had been fighting Lily off with a stick. She would begin going over her lines, what she would say to the Mort at the far end of the bridge, and then Lily would intrude, her grasping fingers of memory weaving through Kelsey's thoughts until the two seemed indistinguishable. Distant pops of gunfire, visions of a burning skyline, and the screams of the dying. But despite these things, Kelsey wished she could simply sink back into Lily's life. It was a troubled time that Lily lived in, troubled and terrible. But her choices were not Kelsey's. Lily's life demanded nothing but endurance. Kelsey looked up and saw white sails, riggings, a ship. People standing at the helm. She shook her head, but the vision remained in front of her, blurred slightly, as though overlaid with a veil of the thinnest material. For a moment, Kelsey felt as though she could reach out and tear that veil away, step through the centuries to stand beside Lily, to become Lily. Could I do that? She wondered, blinking up at the ship, its billowing sails white shadows in the night. Could I simply cross and not come back? For a moment, this idea was so seductive that Kelsey had to battle it, the way she would have battled an opponent with a knife. She looked down at her sapphires, feeling as though she were really seeing them for the first time. For months, she had operated under the assumption that her sapphires were dead. But why? The dreams, the steady transformation of her own appearance, the cuts on her body, Lily's pain, Lily's life. These things had not come out of a vacuum. Kelsey took her jewels, one in each hand, and held them up to the light. Physically, they were identical, but she sensed great difference between them. If she only had time to sort it out! The sun was rising, but still she hesitated. You're not dead. She marvelled, staring at the jewels in her hands. Lily's world pulled at her again, demanding that she return, that she watch the end of the story. But Kelsey dropped her jewels and began walking. The vision of the sails finally dimmed as she reached the toll gate at the eastern end of the bridge. The toll tables were all empty now. No one had entered or left New London via the bridge since the army took it over. Kelsey should have been exhausted, but she felt wide awake. The knoll beyond the toll gate was covered with Mort soldiers, all of them armed for battle, with swords and several knives at the belt. Even now, the sight of all that good steel hurt Kelsey deep inside. Her army, what remained of it anyway, had so few good weapons. At the head of the Mort column stood a man in full armour, partially balding, with sleepy eyes that threw Kelsey off for a moment. But the eyes behind the drooping lids were shrewd and pitiless, just as she remembered them through her spyglass. She greeted him in Mort. General Ducat. The Queen of the Tierling, I presume? His eyes darted over her shoulder toward the bridge. Have you come to beg my mistress for leniency? You will not get it. I've come to speak to... your mistress. It was a strange term to use, and Kelsey realized that Carlin's Mort lessons, good as they had been, might have skipped something in the way of idiom. Ducat's heavy-lidded eyes blinked toward the fallen bridge again, and then blinked away.
She will not see you.
I think she will. Kelsey stepped closer, and was astonished when he took her half-step back, several of the soldiers behind him doing the same. Could it be possible that they were afraid of her?
It seemed ludicrous with the might of the Mort army lying just over the hill.
Ducat shouted in rapid-fire Mort, "Andrew, run and tell the Queen what goes on here."
One of the men in the line turned and sprinted away over the crest of the hill, where the sky was rapidly turning from pink to orange. Dawn was here, and Kelsey suddenly found this delay intolerable, worse than the idea of her own death.
Ducat did not want negotiations, she saw now, not even if it would benefit Mortmain or his mistress.
Ducat wanted to march into New London, wanted to lay waste to all he found there. He was looking forward to the sack, looking forward to
carnival.
That was the right word. The man in front of her might as well have been Parker, anticipating the fall of the world. William Tyr had said something about men like Parker, that they were built for this, built to spoil things. And Kelsey suddenly saw that at all costs she must keep this man out of her city. She had broken the bridge, but that was not enough. On the other side of the hill was siege towers, rams. New London was not built to withstand assault, and the Mort army was hungry for plunder. Once they started, they would not stop.
"You want to let me pass, General?"
"That's for my mistress to decide."
But Kelsey could not wait. She had already begun to probe at Ducat, browsing through him in the same way she would have looked through Carlin's library. Here was a man who was not afraid to die.
Like Mace.
But nothing else was similar. This man was cold, not one to be swayed by pleas or pity.
Only pain and self-preservation would buy him, Kelsey decided. So she found the soft meat of his groin and dug in hard.
"Ducat!" cried out. Several of the men behind him stepped forward, but Kelsey shook her head.
"Don't even think about it. Not unless you want a piece of the same."
They backed away, and Kelsey saw that they were indeed afraid. She turned back to Ducat, loosening her hold for a moment.
"The longer you make me wait here, General, the more I feel a need for such diversions."
Ducat stared at her wide-eyed. Kelsey suspected that he had never been held powerless before.
A famous interrogator, Ducat.
And that made her think of Langer, the accountant. Such people did not do well on the other side of the table.
"I have business with your mistress. Let me pass."
"She will not negotiate," he gasped. "Even I won't defy her. She is terrible."
"Let me tell you a secret, General. I am worse."
She gave his testes another hard squeeze, and Ducat screamed, a high womanish sound.
Kelsey was almost enjoying herself now, a low, dirty sort of pleasure, just as she had felt during Fawn's execution. How easy and pleasant it was to punish those who deserved punishment. She could reduce this man to meat, and her own death would almost be worth it.
"Kelsey," Carlin whispered behind her. The voice was so close that Kelsey turned her head, half expecting to see Carlin standing just over her shoulder. But nothing was there. Only her city standing behind her, wide open, in the blue light of early dawn.
The sight shook Kelsey, reminded her that she did not belong to herself. Even the magic she used now, magic that she had essentially taught herself, was not hers. It belonged to William Tyr. And Tyr would never have allowed anything to divert his attention from the main prize. The better world.
"Take me to her, General,
and I will stop." All of the blood had drained from Ducat's face now. He looked up and over the hillside behind him, his gaze frustrated at the battering rams that stood ready. Kelsey saw the tenor of Ducat's thoughts now, his ambitions, and she had to stomp down her anger to leash it as one would a dog.
"Take me to her now, General, or I swear to you you will not be able to enjoy your siege. You will no longer be equipped to do so."
Ducat swore, and then turned and began tromping back up the hill. Kelsey followed, surrounded by six of Ducat's men, a group that had the feeling of a guard. This gave Kelsey pause. Did Ducat really need a guard in his own encampment? He was not a man who inspired loyalty, but it seemed extraordinary that he could be that hated. Even this picked guard, Kelsey noticed, made sure to steer well clear of her, travelling perhaps 20 feet out to the side. They topped the hill, and Kelsey halted briefly, stunned by what she saw. Looking down at the Mort camp from the walls of New London was a very different proposition from seeing it up close. Black tents seemed to stretch for miles into the distance, and Kelsey's first thought was to wonder how they kept from overheating when the sun was up. Then she noticed the sheer, almost reflective nature of the fabric, and her earlier anger recurred. Always, Mortmain had something new. As they entered the camp, the six men tightened up around her, and Kelsey saw the reason soon enough. The path they were traversing passed between many tents, and the men, lining either side, looked at her like hungry dogs. Kelsey tried to prepare for violence, but didn't know what good it would do. The invisible wall she had sensed the other day was still there, protecting the camp. Did the woman never sleep? As they moved farther toward the center, whispering became hissing. And the hissing gradually resolved itself into discreet comments that Kelsey wished she could unhear.
Dear bitch. When our lady is done with you, I'll use you until you break.
Ducat made no sign that he had heard them. Kelsey straightened her shoulders and stared straight ahead, trying to remind herself that she had been threatened before, that people had been trying to kill her all of her life. But this, the hostility and bile raining down from all sides, some in mort and some in broken tear, this was very different, and Kelsey was afraid.
She'll make you beg for death.
So much hate. Where does it come from? Kelsey wanted to weep, not for herself, but for the waste, the thought of how many extraordinary things could have been accomplished in the new world. She could not close her ears to them, so she searched for Lily, and found her, just beneath the surface, staring up at the night sky, the white sails in the moonlight. But the sails were billowing now, as though stirred by a strong wind. I missed it, Kelsey realized sadly. She had missed the launch. But Lily had made it. Lily was on board one of the ships. Grief threatened to overwhelm Kelsey, but she battled it, thinking of William Tyr, of the main prize. They turned another corner, and now Kelsey glimpsed a hint of scarlet through the mass of black. The Red Queen. Soon Kelsey would stand in front of her, face to face. In all the long, blurred night past, this was the one thing she had avoided thinking about. A piece of discarded metal caught her left foot, and Kelsey nearly fell in the mud, landing heavily on her ankle. The jeering of the men seemed to double in volume. Her body was exhausted from more than a day without sleep, and it was beginning to show. But her mind... her mind felt bright and sharp, sure of its course, if she could only hold herself together a bit longer. The crimson tent loomed ahead, and Kelsey was frightened. But there was relief as well, a sense that her approaching fate was now so final that it couldn't be averted. She was nearly done.
The Queen was nervous. She didn't know why. All things were proceeding better than she could have devised. The girl was coming, actually delivering herself, when the Queen had thought they would have to fight tooth and nail to get into the keep. She was wearing both jewels. Ducat's runner had been very definite on that point. This development simplified matters enormously. But the Queen didn't trust it, for it seemed too easy. She had not seen the Tyr sapphires in more than a century,
and even as a child she had never been able to study them as she would have liked. Elaine never took the heir's necklace off, and the Queen's mother had never let her close enough. The sapphires would be the last piece of the puzzle. The Queen was sure of it. But all the same, her heartbeat was up, and her left leg twitched madly, tapping and tapping beneath her skirts. How to get hold of them? From the dark thing, she knew that she could not simply snatch the things off the girl's neck, not without suffering a terrible consequence. The dark thing had been working on the girl, that much was obvious. But the Queen had no idea how far that work had progressed, what the girl could do. Did she present an actual threat? It seemed unlikely, not with her crown city under the knife. But the dark thing was an extraordinary liar, one of the best the Queen had ever encountered. Who knew what the girl might have learned, what she believed? The Queen couldn't know, and not knowing tormented her. She had few vulnerabilities left, but in this moment she was excruciatingly aware of those which remained, and it seemed unfair that they should come to the forefront now, when she was so close to holding the solution in her hand. Now she heard a new sound, the gathering roar of her soldiers. What could the girl hope to accomplish by coming here? Did she seek martyrdom? The girl had already demonstrated a marked weakness for the grand gesture. Although such demonstrations were so revealing that the Queen felt they constituted weakness in themselves. The din outside grew louder, and the Queen drew herself up straight, casting around the tent to make sure that everything was ready. Ducat had procured a low table for her to eat meals on, an extravagance that would now come in handy. She would kill the girl, certainly. But first, they would have a conversation. There were so many things the Queen was curious about. For a moment, she considered drawing the flaps of her tent so that she could watch as the girl approached. But no, the girl was coming as a supplicant, and the Queen would treat her as one. She remained standing, hands at her sides, though her heartbeat kept climbing, and her leg went like mad beneath her dress.
"Majesty!" Ducat called.
Come. Ducat pulled back the flap of the tent, creating a doorway, and the girl ducked through. The anxiety that had been growing on the Queen in the past 10 minutes suddenly crystallized, and when the girl straightened, revealing her face to the light, it took all of the Queen's years of control to keep from taking a step backward. Before her stood the woman in the portrait. Everything was the same. Hair, nose, mouth, even the lines of deep sorrow around her eyes.
Is it a trick? The Queen wondered.
But how could that be? She had smuggled the portrait from the keep more than 100 years ago. Her eyes dropped to the girl's stomach, and she was relieved to notice at least one difference. This girl was not pregnant. But otherwise, the detail was exact. And the Queen felt suddenly as though something had been stolen. The portrait, the woman, these things were hers alone. The girl had no right to stand here wearing the woman's face. She stood straight, her posture defiant, with no hint of begging about her. And this deepened the Queen's unease, her sense that something had been tilted askew.
"The Queen of the Tearling," Ducat announced,
rather unnecessarily. And the Queen flicked her hand toward the door.
"Perhaps I should stay, Majesty."
"Perhaps not," the Queen replied. She had spotted another difference now, and this one steadied her, lessened her sense of disorientation. Unlike the woman in the portrait, the girl had deep green eyes, the same Raleigh eyes that the Queen had once wished for with all her heart. Both sapphires lay on the girl's chest, just as Andrew had reported, and once the Queen had noticed them, she could not tear her gaze away.
"Majesty, the new London Bridge. I know all of this, Benin. Go."
Ducat left, dropping the flap of the tent behind him.
"Please, sit."
The Queen offered the far chair, and after a moment's hesitation, the girl stalked forward to take it. Her eyes were bloodshot, and the Queen wondered at this.
What did the girl cry for?
Not herself, surely. She had already proven that she had no interest in her.